But just before I introduce Dr. Burton, I'd like to say we're very fortunate to have a group visiting us, a group of senior officials from the University of Nanjing in China, who are visiting University of Waterloo today, and are actually going to be participating and listening to some of the presentations and talks here at OAPT. So thank you very much for coming along. To introduce the next speaker, as I said, Dr. Howard Burton, Executive Director here. Since its inception in 1999, he has led all of the developments here at Perimeter Institute. In his capacity as Executive Director, he crafted the Institute's unique outreach and research mandates, coordinated the Board of Directors, attracted a scientific advisory committee made up of leading scientists from around the world, including a number of Nobel laureates, developed the Institute's successful recruiting strategy, initiated all of its outreach programs, and was even deeply involved in the design of this very building we're all in now. Today, Perimeter Institute is widely known as an international center of excellence in two areas, fundamental research in theoretical physics, with scientists recruited from all around the globe, educational outreach, with a variety of special programs that share the joys of inquiry and physics with the wider community at large. Howard himself, in terms of his education, holds a PhD in theoretical physics from the University of Waterloo, a master's in science from, or master's science degree in theoretical physics from Imperial College in London, England, and a Master of Arts in Philosophy from the University of Toronto. He travels widely, is a voracious reader, and has written in the past a popular weekly column for Waterloo's local newspaper, The Record, as well as being sought out in various other media. He continues to be sought out as a speaker on a number of topics and has been interviewed by CFRB Radio, CBC National Radio, the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, TV Ontario, CTV National News, CNN, and other members of the popular press. So without any further ado, Dr. Howard Burton.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Damien. Thank you all for being here. That's an incredibly long introduction. And with the introduction and all these microphones that are now turning on, it seems, I fear you might well be disappointed. Expectations are built rather high. What I thought I would do is just give you a bit of background as to how the Institute came about. And, well, actually, I have this fancy thing here. So the structure of the talk is just to tell you a little bit more about the Institute, and Damien alluded to some of it, but I'll try to give you a little bit more detail. And I'll try to focus on the why rather than the what. You can see some of the what that's around you, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well. But try to give you a sense as to what happened, why it happened, where we are today, and basically what it means for you. But before I start, I should say that it's really fantastic for us to be able to host this event. This is exactly the sort of thing that we were hoping to do when we founded the Institute, to be able to have not only a forum to be able to interact with high school physics teachers, but be able to have an opportunity to hopefully add to their experience and be able to think about ways that we can constructively engage with that whole community and maybe give some serious value to it. So let me tell you about the origins of the Institute. It's a curious story. As Damien mentioned, I finished my PhD in theoretical physics, and I started a little bit late. I took some time off, and I lived in Europe for a while. And so when I came back to do my PhD, I had perhaps a different level of understanding than people who start when they're a little bit younger. I was 29 when I started my PhD. So I had a sense that I wasn't probably going to go on and do the professorial thing and chase postdocs for another 10 years and this sort of thing. I had this notion, encouraged strongly by my wife, to have a standard of living above that of your average field mouse. So I thought it was probably useful to go back I wanted to go back and study things in mathematical physics that I had found really captivating and interesting that was actually triggered from my experience in England. And then I thought I'll go back and get a job like everybody else. So I did that, and I had a lot of fun doing the PhD. And then I was going to go to Wall Street, which is the standard well, one of the standard routes to go for somebody who's who has some expertise in mathematical science, and learned a bit about that, and hustled around and eventually got a position at an investment bank in New York City. And this was in 1999, and I don't know if you guys remember 1999, but in 1999, everybody was getting rich all over the place. And not all of them had really good ideas, but interesting things were happening. And I thought, well, I'm a fairly smart guy. I should be able to do something like that as well, rather than work as a quant and live in New Jersey and be on work as a quant in Wall Street. So I applied to various companies, and I knew that if I applied to, I did some research, I looked at some interesting emerging companies, but I knew that if I applied to human resources, they'd say, you're not a software engineer, you're not, you don't have an MBA, you don't have this, so go away. So I wrote to the CEOs directly. And I wrote a standard supplicant letter saying, here I am, I have degrees in these various different fields, I have wonderful mathematical skills, I have wonderful communication skills, please help save me from a lucrative career on Wall Street. And a few people responded, and one of them was Mike Lazaridis of Research in Motion, the gentleman over there to the right. So as it happens, RIM has two CEOs, Mike and Jim Balsley, so I wrote to both of them, no other one of them. So Mike responded, and he said, well, you can always work at RIM, we're always looking for bright people, and Mike was interesting insofar as he had a lot of respect for the idea of somebody even having a PhD in theoretical physics, which alone, I think, distinguishes him from many of his corporate colleagues. To give you a little bit of background about RIM, RIM was founded by Mike and two of his colleagues in 1984. They went public many years after that, in 1997, and then BlackBerry was announced in the beginning of 1999. So he found himself in this position of having more wealth than he had ever dreamt of. And he's starting to turn his attention to doing something philanthropic, because Mike, again, somewhat different from many of his corporate colleagues, is of the view that, well, if you have this money, you should be doing something with it, whatever it happens to be, rather than buying sports franchises or impressing your friends and having more money than the next guy. So let's see if I can use this money. So this is his thought process going on. And then he gets this letter from this guy, and he thinks, hey, I'm just thinking about doing something. Don't really know what to do. Physics, I always thought physics was cool. The whole Star Trek thing, the whole technology thing, the whole science thing. Maybe I'll meet this guy. So we have this bizarre series of discussions that culminates in a face-to-face meeting in a restaurant in Brampton. Mike has just given a talk at Nortel, and we meet each other for the first time, and we go off to a restaurant. And so I'm a bit confused by the whole thing, because I'm not really sure what he wants. And what I learned later, of course, he's a little bit confused by the whole thing, because he's really not sure. We're talking, and he's getting very excited, and he's talking about new forms of communication and science fiction type of stuff, and you know, EPR type of correlations, and the importance of physics and the importance of science. And he's getting very excited, as he tends to do, if you know Mike, because he believes very strongly in the power of science. He doesn't profess to be a scientist, but he's an engineer and obviously a damn good one. And so we're talking like this for a couple of hours. And after a few hours, he turns to me and he says, so were you interested? And I say, interested in what? I have no idea what we're talking about. And then he gets out a napkin, because we're at this restaurant, and he writes a number down. And he hands me the napkin. And then I realize that we are in the salary negotiation part of this Kafkaesque exercise that I don't understand. And he says, what do you think of that? And it's fairly small, uninspiring entry-level number, but I can't take the whole thing very seriously. And I say, well, that's fine, sure, whatever. That's great, he says. Hand him back the napkin. So I say, after another pause, what would you like me to do? Figuring that if this is really a job, I should take it a little bit more seriously. And he says, with characteristic prescience, he says, I don't want you to do anything. I just want you to think. Okay. See, I've done that for years. Didn't get paid very much more than this anyway. Because he says, I have some experience in these things. When I started RIM, I had a few opportunities to think about things and structure things, and then all hell broke loose. And basically, I had to, I got distracted. So now's your chance to really think about things. Okay. So I left the restaurant thinking that was an interesting way to spend an afternoon. And I phoned my wife, and I said to her, I think I have a job. And she said, what do you mean you think you have a job? And what about this thing on Wall Street and moving to, no, no, completely different. Met this guy, he showed me a napkin, different story altogether. Oh, she says to me on the over the phone, so what do you have to do for this new fancy job? I have to think. I say, that's my job. So we can't take it very seriously, and I go home. And I'm living in Toronto at the time. I'm living in the beaches, or the beach, the controversy. Anyway, I'm living there by the water. And we think, well, that was interesting. And a few days later, I get this courier check in the mail. And I think, oh my God, this is serious. I better start thinking. So I start thinking, and I go for walks up and down on the boardwalk in Toronto. And I'm thinking about what might be possible. And it's interesting because I think we've all had these sorts of experiences. We all go through as elementary school students, as high school students, as undergraduates, and so forth, and potentially as graduate students or what have you. And as we're doing this, we're thinking, you know, something about this doesn't really make sense. Maybe if they structured it this way, or if they did something that way, or if we could improve it this way. And you stay up late at night at coffee shops, and you talk to your friends, and you think, how would it be if I ran the world? And you don't take it very seriously, and then you go on and you progress. And it occurs to me as I'm thinking along the boardwalk, I think, well, this is very interesting because I actually have an opportunity to do something. I have an opportunity to put some of those thoughts into practice that most people just don't have. And as I did more reading and as I did more thinking, I realized that the opportunity I had through dumb luck, through no brilliant skill of my own, was really remarkable. It was almost unprecedented. The closest precedent, and I think in many ways a not at all dissimilar precedent, was the one that Abraham Flexner had when he founded the Institute for Advanced Study in 1930 with the Bamberger money. So I realized, my goodness, we can do interesting things here. And the whole motivation was, how can we make a difference? How can we do something? How can we structure an environment that can address some real need, some societal need, some research need? How can we contribute in some unique way that is necessary, that is positive, that is different? Not different for the sake of being different, but different to address some needs. And that was the whole ethos, and that was how we moved forwards in structuring the Institute. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Okay. I guess the only other thing I want to mention from this slide, a bit of timeline. So as I mentioned, I met Mike in the summer of 1999. We appointed a board of directors in the fall of 1999. And in January of 2000, I began to go on travels to different research institutions throughout North America and Europe. So I visited the Institute for Advanced Study. I visited the then ITP, now KITP in Santa Barbara. I visited the Santa Fe Institute. I visited, they weren't all physics institutes. They weren't even all science institutes. Most of them were physics institutes. But I went to Trieste, I went to CERN, I went here and there. And I would ask people a litany of questions in different positions. What's working in terms of management structure? What's not working? What's working in terms of research orientation? What's not working? How are the groups interacting? How are you interacting with the surrounding academic community? How are you interacting with the surrounding non-academic community? What's the architecture of the building? How would you design a building that would be different? I asked, what would you do differently for your institution if you had the chance to raise it to the ground and start over again? And I got a wealth of responses. I also asked more detailed science questions because I had some idea as to what sort of things we might be going into about who would you recommend in terms of this particular area or that particular area. Would you be interested in serving on a scientific advisory committee or who might you recommend? All of these sorts of questions. And I got a wealth of information that came back to me. And from that, and my own additional research, I wrote reports and recommendations to the board. And from that, the board approved an overall mandate of the institute, which I'll show you in a minute. But again, the key is we're looking at it from the prism of how we can really contribute something distinct and positive. Because after all, this was a new opportunity. There were new monies. There was a new place. There was a whole chance to rethink things soup to nuts, which really doesn't happen very often. So we thought, it's a great opportunity. It's also, of course, a great responsibility to at least do the best you can to do sufficient due diligence. OK. So let me get to the mandate here. So it's a lot of words. It's always irritating when people put up PowerPoint slides with words. You should never do that. So let me just go through this very, very quickly. And I highlighted that. So the things that are highlighted in bold are not, they're just highlighted for the purposes of this slide. They're not in bold in the actual mandate or mission statement. So we decided to be independent, resident-based, as opposed to an institute which functions primarily and overwhelmingly for the sake of hosting programs, conferences, workshops, and so forth. We, of course, have designed this to be able to do that as well, but that's not our overwhelming focus as it is for the Newton Institute for Mathematical Sciences, or for that matter, the KITP and other places. So an independent, resident-based research institute devoted to foundational issues in theoretical physics, the highest levels of international excellence. So we strive to create a lively and dynamic research atmosphere where many approaches to foundational questions or fundamental questions, both orthodox and unorthodox, are pursued simultaneously. So let me just talk about that for just a few minutes. So what do I mean by orthodox and unorthodox? And how does this relate to what I said before about these late night coffee conversations? Well, particularly when I was a graduate student, but also when you're an undergraduate student, you notice that there are these there's a bizarre aspect of the sociology of theoretical physics, especially, I think, in these days, as you tend to be pretty far away from experiment. So Paula mentioned string theory and so forth. So it's you get a very, very, you tend to get very rigorous sociological distinctions that are being made because you don't have the data to be able to distinguish whether this is right or that's right. And sometimes that's reasonable because there are compelling mathematical reasons to subscribe to one approach over the other. But you tend to get almost this, you almost get these sort of religions, this doctrinaire approach which tends to happen. And I don't think that's in the best interest of science, and I think there are a lot of people who agree that that's not in the best interest. So you want to make sure that you, as you're approaching these questions, you approach them from a somewhat wider context, and you have different approaches that are scientifically meritorious, of course. And so you notice these sorts of things. When I was a graduate student, I used to say, well, what about this sort of approach, and how does this work? Oh, well, that's ridiculous. Those guys are just crazy. And there wasn't it tended to devolve into ad hominem attacks rather than a rigorous scientific analysis of why they were doing what they were doing. So I thought, that's stupid. We're all in this to try to figure out what's going on. Surely it makes sense to see if we can create an atmosphere where you can somehow have people who are approaching things from different perspectives, maybe not having a group hug and singing kumbaya together, but at least have some sense of tolerance for one another within the confines of the same place where, God forbid, they might actually learn from one another. So, of course, you have to be careful. Because as soon as you say unorthodox, well, there's a lot of stuff, and everybody in this room is intimately aware of that, there's a lot of stuff which is unorthodox because it damn well should be unorthodox, because it's flaky, because it's stupid, because it makes no sense. And there's probably nobody in the physics community who hasn't experienced at least one or two people coming up to them and saying that they have a perpetual motion machine in their basement, and you know, this kind of stuff. So you have to be very, very careful what you mean by that. And we have no intention of being the flaky institute or the institute for lost causes. But we do have an intention of being a place which can embrace competing meritorious perspectives simultaneously, or at least have some tolerance for it. So that's the first issue that that's part of our mandate in terms of this notion of making a difference on the research side. There's also the idea of this balance between formal and phenomenologically oriented research. So what do I mean by that? Well, again, as I mentioned, we're living in an age when foundational issues tend to be very mathematical and abstract, and many of them are really removed from experiment. But we're a physics institute, and we're not a mathematics institute. So it's part of our mandate to make sure that as we move into the more formal, abstract areas like string theory and other approaches to quantum gravity and so forth, we're always trying to balance that with things that have some relevance to experiment or some possible experiments that we can imagine or some aspects of the real world. And I'll tell you a little bit more about how we try to fulfill that mandate in a moment. I don't want to talk too much about that because I want to talk a little bit more about the outreach programs. So I highlight the fact that we're trying to include graduate students. It's when we decided to be independent, we elected to be independent for the reasons you might imagine. It gives us more flexibility to try new programs. It gives us opportunity to have the freedom to pursue different avenues of research and to hire people at different rates and move more proactively and all the rest of that, to be away from a lot of the big bureaucracies that larger institutions tend to have. That being said, there was a constant danger that was reinforced to me on my travels, and the message went like this. It said, well, be independent for all those reasons I just mentioned, but find a way to be somehow structurally dynamic, because independent research institutions often have a habit of being places that go great guns for the first 5 years, and then they become entrenched, and they don't have this sense of dynamism that renews them. And the important sense of dynamism is actually brought more often than not by students. So if you're an independent organization, and you're not associated formally with any university, well, how do you get the students? And how do you get that structural dynamism? So we started developing mechanisms where we could work with surrounding universities and graduate programs and so forth. And that's an important, I don't have time to go into that, but that's an important part of the mandate, and that's why. And then lastly, which is perhaps most important for this conversation, is this notion of having a very vigorous outreach program. So why are we doing that? We don't have to. Most places don't. Virtually every international physics institute doesn't have that as part of their mandate. They may do some things, but they don't have it as part of their core mandate. Why do we? Well, the short answer is because we can. Because we can, because we're independent, because this whole initiative and this whole exercise was motivated by the question of, well, how can we do things differently and positively? What's wrong, or what needs to be improved, or what, in our judgment, could we affect in a positive way? And so there are all these scientific things that I mentioned. But there's also a much broader issue, which is, how is it possible in this scientific technological age in which we find ourselves, there's such a low respect and understanding and appreciation for science? How is it possible that there is not an awareness of the importance of balancing basic research and applied research in an era where governments are constantly saying commercialize, 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 and that's fine, and that's good, and that's great, because we all appreciate the fact that that's important to our GDP and all the rest of that. But it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient in terms of developing the right culture and attracting people who are interested by basic fundamental questions. And it's not sufficient in terms of the science itself. Because if everybody's working on trying to commercialize the latest development, then you're not going to be able to have the next level of basic research in a whole plethora of different areas. So I'm preaching to the choir. I'm not expecting a huge debate over these issues to the audience, although there have been different audiences where you get a bigger debate. But the point is, that was the motivation for us. So the idea, hey, this is a need, this is important, we can do this, and there's something else. What better hook? What better hook than a physics institute that is founded by a phenomenally successful engineer who clearly believes in technology, who clearly knows something about commercialization, who clearly believes in science, to be able to say, wait a minute, it's not science is, technology is wonderful, it's important, it's essential. But in order for our society to progress, we have to have a balance between basic research and applied research for all the reasons I said before. We have this wonderful opportunity to captivate people's attention, not only because of that positioning, but also because this gentleman gave $100 million of his own money. He invested $100 million of his own money towards a theoretical physics institute. So unlike your standard advocates for basic research and academic research in academia, you could line up 30 Nobel laureates who would say, it's important to study basic research in the sciences. And everybody would say, yeah, yeah, that's fine. That's what your Nobel laureates are supposed to say. But when you have an extremely successful engineer who develops this wonderful tech device, and then he donates, or invests, rather, $100 million of his own money for a theoretical physics institute, the obvious question that everybody's going to ask is, why would he do that? And that gives you an entree, or an entree, if you prefer to speak a coherent language, into the general public. It gives you an opportunity to start describing to them not only the way commercialization is really done, and not only how you should structure society, but how exciting and interesting and important these ideas are. And that's an opportunity that obviously resonates with myself and with the board from an ideological perspective, from an idealistic perspective, from a philosophical perspective. But it's something which is an opportunity which we have that other institutions would not have. There's one other point, I guess, that I should make before I go telling you a little bit more specifically about the programs themselves. And that is that because of the way we've created this, where we have a fully fledged theoretical research institute with an outreach mandate, these things are able to feed each other, and we can leverage one off the other. So we can, it's interesting, when you're in the business of recruiting scientists to come here, you realize that many of them are really interested in the idea of a new research institute that has this as part of its mandate. They resonate with this, and we all know this. This is not a big surprise. They believe in these ideas. They went into physics because they were overwhelmed with curiosity, and they were captivated by the power of ideas. And they want to share that in the right context. They don't want to have to organize everything. They don't want to have to administrate everything. But they love the idea. Many of them love the idea of being able to transmit their joy and enthusiasm and excitement for science to not only the general public, to students, to teachers. When we run teacher workshops here, and you'll have some keynotes, I think Mike Mosca is giving a talk, and Cliff Burgess is giving a talk, we don't have to twist the arms of these guys to talk to high school physics teachers. They're excited about doing that. There's a real sense of being able to make a difference that resonates with them and helps to create the atmosphere and the culture here, which gives us a buzz and hopefully a competitive advantage when we're trying to compete with the Princetons and the Harvards and so forth of the world, which is highly non-trivial, of course. So there's that. But there's also the fact that our outreach programs get directly assisted in the other direction, of course, by the research staff, by the presence of the fact that we are a fully functioning research institution. Not only because we can call these people in to participate in our various programs, and we can have them assist in the development of our new programs, but also because we can leverage the credibility and the expertise of being not just an outreach organization per se, but a fully fledged physics institute. So this gives us additional advantages, not just in being different, that too, but additional structural advantages, which we're quite excited about capitalizing on. Okay, so I'm not going to go through all of this. I told you a little bit about this. We started research operations in 2001 in this building, which is just up the street. We started with a very small number of faculty and postdocs. Some of those guys are visitors, actually. And now we opened this building in 2004. And we've been here since the fall of 2004. So I talked about all this stuff. So here are some of the core research areas. And let me just say, this all falls within the rubric of basic research. It's all foundational physics. If you look at this, you can pick out the stuff that is more in terms of the balance that I said before of formal and phenomenological. So you've got cosmology and particle physics and quantum information theory, quantum computing, where you have opportunities for real interaction with experimentalists. You get data in cosmology, of course. The LHC is coming online in particle physics. And there's a new institute that was part of a larger strategic development at the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. So there's a whole panoply of quantum computing technologies. So that will be emerging over the next few years. And there's a wealth of experimental initiatives that are being pursued. So these are areas where we have a closer tie-in with either experiment or possible experiment or certainly data in accordance with that aspect of the mandate, as opposed to more formal areas such as foundations of quantum theory, which has a link to quantum information theory, but nonetheless is more abstract and mathematical, quantum gravity, superstring theory, these sorts of ideas. So that's one aspect of the mandate that I said there. The other aspect in terms of having a wider tent, so we're one of the few places that does foundations of quantum theory as distinct from quantum information theory. There's quite a bit of overlap between those areas, but it's not a one-to-one match by any stretch of the imagination. So we still have people who do different approaches to foundational issues in quantum theory and can again be butting heads and pushing the people who are quantum information theorists to say, well, does this really make sense? Is this really the way it must be? Or is this just a convenient protocol or nice calculational tool? Similarly with quantum gravity and superstring theory. So superstring theory is I would say, certainly the dominant approach to these sorts of areas, and the dominant approach, I think, for very good reasons. But by no means is it the only game in town necessarily. And we have people here who do different approaches that have their strengths and weaknesses as well. So I'm not going to go into any more of that. And instead, I'm going to move into the outreach component. So let me tell you a little bit more about what sorts of things we do. And let me preface these comments by saying that we've done some things. We've started some things. We've been doing them for 4 or 5 years. We've embellished upon them. We've developed them a little bit further. But we're certainly not in the position of saying that that anything is written in stone. I'll mention this at the end, which is going to happen reasonably quickly. I'll mention this at the end that what we're really looking for by hosting these events and having collections of individuals such as yourselves is a mechanism for real feedback where we can get interesting ideas about how best we can work with you and what you might think would be a positive development or what sort of things we might want to structure that we haven't considered or how we might better want to do things or what have you. So we're obviously learning as we go. We have two core programs for students. We have this summer camp of which you might have heard, ISSYP, which is the International Summer School for Young Physicists. So we've been running this for a few years now. It started off as a national program where we took 20 high school students from across Canada to come for mentorship sessions with our faculty and courses in modern physics and so forth. It was an elite program. Then we doubled it and made it international, so we have 20 Canadians and 20 from around the world. This year we're doubling that program again, so we're having two camps that are going on. And again, we have a split of 50-50 between Canadian participants and foreign participants from countries from around the world. Our in-school program that Damien runs is Physica Fantastica. And I'm not sure if he'll have the opportunity to talk to you more formally during this conference about that, but you should certainly speak to him about that informally if he doesn't have that opportunity. And basically the idea is not only to go in to the schools and talk about specific interesting ideas in modern physics and to try to give people specific takeaways. So it's pedagogical in that sense, but the motivation is more, at least from my perspective, to try to really enlighten people as to the mindset of a working physicist. What people are really doing, what the lifestyle is like, and what the game is really all about. There is this, to me it's always disappointing sometimes, well, sometimes it's disappointing, when I talk to high school students And there's this sense that everything is done. There's this lack of curiosity. The answer's always in the back of the book, you know, and everything's already been found out and discovered. And there's not this awareness of all the stuff that we don't know and all the blind alleys that the scientists have gone down for years and sometimes centuries. There's not the appreciation for the mysteries and the joys and the wonders and the bizarreness of the universe. So part of the subtext of this program is to try to trigger that a little bit, to try to help the teachers by having somebody else come in and say, look, here are all the things we don't know, and there are lots of them. And here's what we've tried to address on this. But to try to give them an understanding of the scientific culture and the research culture that they might not ordinarily have. We have programs for teachers. So we've been doing this for a few years, where we ran, or rather we're running, a national teacher workshop called Einstein Plus. And we have some international participation as well, which we're keen to do, where the teachers come for 4 or 5 days to the Institute. They have keynotes from our research faculty to get a sense of what interesting topics are that researchers are working on and what their stumbling blocks are and what their impediments are. They're working with Damien and others to have concrete takeaways for modern physics and for, conceptual developments that they can actually have some, perhaps they can work through some various examples of. There's opportunities to network and there's opportunities for them to be able to develop a stronger teacher nationwide infrastructure. We do regional teacher workshops as well throughout different regions across the country. We have programs for the general public. Goodness, my mic suddenly turned on. So we do public lectures on a monthly level. That's not terribly surprising. A lot of people do public lectures on a monthly level. I think we're somewhat unique in that our lectures have been perhaps more successful than others, and I'd like to think that that speaks to our fantastic organizational prowess and our wonderful marketing and so forth, and there is certainly a lot of hard work, but I think it also shows that there's a little bit of if you build it, they will come that's going on. And when I started this years ago and was thinking about ways of engaging the public, I thought, isn't it odd that people talk about how nobody wants to hear about science and scientific issues, and there's so much evidence in the other direction? I mean, A Brief History of Time was on the bestseller list for, you know, record-breaking amount of time. So, okay, not everybody read it, and not everybody understood it, and there was the phenomenon of Hawking as this remarkably courageous individual who has this crippled body and this incredibly vibrant mind, which is captivating for human interest and so forth. Of course, that's a factor. But there's more than that. People really want to know. People really are curious. And if you can present interesting, mind-blowing ideas in a non-intimidating context, in a lively context, where people can participate and engage, they will participate and engage. So we've been doing this now for, since 2002, I believe. And we've had to move 3 times. When we built this place, the idea was that we would hold the public lectures in this lecture theater, which is now way too small. We hold them in a local high school, which has a capacity of 650 people. And we sell out every month. Now, I say sell out. We don't charge admission, but you do have to book your tickets in advance, which does 2 things. First of all, it gives us a count, and it also enables us to develop a very rigorous database to be able to keep a loyal following of people. But so these are just tactical issues, but at the end of the day, what's important is people are interested. And we don't always have big shot scientists to come in to talk about string theory or supersymmetry or what have you. We have some of that, and we can leverage, as you see from the names up there, we can leverage the people who would be coming through for scientific-related events here anyway. But that's not what it's all about, because people have a certain threshold for that. There are only so many lectures on foundations of quantum theory you can hear before anybody can hear, before their brain starts having had enough. So we try to vary the format. We had a historian who wrote about the scandal at Bell Labs, or rather an English professor who wrote about the scandal at Bell Labs and what it means for the mindset of science and the sociology of science and so forth and the rush to publication. We had that individual giving a talk. We had Jay Ingram giving a talk on his latest book on consciousness. We had Miriam Schuchman giving a talk on medical ethics and her read of the Nancy Olivieri case. We had a historian talk about his particular take on the trials of Galileo. So there are all sorts of ways you can make these issues relevant and interesting and exciting to the general public without having to necessarily be saying, okay, here's the latest specialist in area Y who's going to give you a talk on this. We also run black hole sessions, which are smaller somewhat higher level continuing education courses, effectively, that Damien runs here to talk about more sophisticated topics in theoretical physics and give a little bit more mathematical structure and support for them. We run open houses for the general public. We ran something called Einstein Fest, of which you might have heard, which was a 3-week festival last fall. So everybody was doing something to commemorate the International Year of Physics and the 100th anniversary of Einstein's miracle year in 1905. So obviously we were going to do something like that too. But again, we took a somewhat different take. So the standard thing to do is to talk about what Einstein's papers were really like in 1905 and what Einstein was, what impact they had, what concepts they were really talking about, what Einstein was like as a man, what was motivating him potentially, and so forth. So we did all of that, as you might imagine, and we brought in Einstein scholars and historians and physicists from around the world who were expert in this area to talk about that. But we did something more as well in keeping with the overall outreach mandate that we have here, which was to put it in a broader context. Because the subtext is that science is not done in a vacuum, and it's not done by some geeky underclass or separate class of society that sits in a corner somewhere and does their science stuff. That it's part of the rubric of society, and that these are interesting, exciting questions which have engaged the world's brightest minds throughout history. And that this whole art-science dichotomy and this whole notion that, well, you're just a science guy, so you do this stuff over here as opposed to an arts person who does this, is specious at best and downright dangerous at worst. And so in Einstein Fest, we looked at 1905 and we said, what was happening in 1905? What was happening in art? What was happening in literature? What was happening in psychology? What was happening in music? What were the times like? What was the climate like when these incredibly imaginative ideas were coming out of young Al's brain in 1905? Maybe they influenced him, maybe they didn't influence him, but this is what the world was like, and this is what the world is like now, and Einstein had a lot to do with that. So, plus we got 100 people to wear really cool masks, which is useful. So we're developing the website. In keeping with what I said before, we also do cultural events here. Now, you might ask why we do that. Part of why we do that is for the reasons I just enunciated. Another part is very practical. And very tactical. I'm running a research institute where I'm trying to attract the best and the brightest people in the world to Waterloo. Well, there are advantages and there are disadvantages. And one of the things that we can do is we can independently use whatever means we have to provide the ultimate environment here. Now, one of them is the building itself. So this building was designed with that in mind. We have to do something off-scale. We have to do something which is not only functional at the highest levels. I don't know if you've had a tour yet, but you'll go through and you'll see the interaction areas and the fireplaces and all the rest of that so that people can naturally congregate and meet. And that was done deliberately in the bistro and so forth. It was all done to provide the optimal environment for people to be able to engage and do research in the most comfortable setting possible. But it also had to be attractive. It had to be aesthetically attractive. It had to be functional and it had to be aesthetically pleasing. So that was our... that was our mandate. So we're very pleased at what we've been able to accomplish with respect to the building. And recently we were actually given a Governor General's Award for architecture for the building. That happened just a few weeks ago. But that's not sufficient. So you have a bistro so that you have very good food and you have an interesting, lively atmosphere for people to naturally congregate and discuss ideas. You have high-quality musical performances. You have people like the Beaux-Arts Trio and Matt Heimovitz and Emmanuel Axe, to name a few, who came through here recently. These are people you cannot see in a 200-seat hall on planet Earth. Well, maybe Matt Heimovitz you can, because he sometimes plays in bars in Texas and so forth and does weird stuff. But certainly Emmanuel Axe and the Beaux-Arts Trio. So this is an experience with the highest level of performing artists that are coming right here. It's great for the community, who's embraced it in the biggest possible way, and it's great for our research faculty and for our visitors. Okay, so this is all the stuff we've done. I won't bother going into that. I'll just mention one thing, and that is that the Ontario government and the federal government and the and other bodies such as UNESCO have also endorsed many aspects of what we're doing. We're getting strong support from the government of Ontario and strong support from the government of Canada, to which we're very, very grateful. But it's also very necessary. And it's necessary for two reasons. In the first case, if you get this overwhelming amount of money, this $120 million donation, it's an opportunity to do something at the highest international levels. And the only way you can compete, or a necessary condition, not sufficient, to compete with the Harvards and the Stanfords of the world, is to be able to have an endowment to be able to be sufficiently robust so that you're solvent, that you have the resources, you have the flexibility to be able to do things. Well, if you take that money and you start spending it right away, you're not going to have an endowment very much longer. So that's one reason why it's important to have federal support and provincial support. Another reason, which is perhaps even more important, is credibility. It's really important to have the stamp of approval, the imprimatur, from the federal government and the provincial government to be able to say, we believe in this, this is important, this is what we want to support. As Mike himself said years ago, wouldn't matter how much money I would give to this, or somebody else would give to this. Could be a billion, could be 2 billion. At some point, it just becomes one rich guy's crazy idea. But when you get the governments involved to say, this is what we believe in, this is what we support, it's different. And I can tell you from personal experience, this has a huge impact on recruitment and on the culture here, and on the level of engagement we can have with the society. Okay, I won't tell you too much more about this because I'm way out of time and I don't want to hold you back, other than to say that on the research side, we're expanding. So we've got this big building. It's quickly becoming not big enough, which is always a sign of success. We're still looking to expand to the extent that we're looking to double or perhaps even in the fullness of time, whatever that means, triple our faculty. So we now have, I can't remember whether it's off the top of my head, whether it's 10 or 11 full-time researchers here, and we also have 8 associates who are part-time researchers who are here. And we have about 25 postdocs now, and then graduate students, and we have 10 long-term visitors who are here from anywhere from 6 months to 3 years and so, and lots of short-term visitors. That gives you a sense of the scale of research activity. So certainly we're looking to expand our number of faculty and our number of postdocs. We're looking to expand on a whole host of fronts, on outreach front, on the programs for the general public, on the programs for teachers, on the programs for students. We're developing products, educational products. We're interested in having much more of an international impact. We're scaling up our website. We're developing a whole host of new programs and initiatives. And it would be wonderful to have your help and your support in terms of, and your ideas in terms of how best we might want to move forwards in all of these initiatives. And lastly, I just want to say that getting back to my earlier point about society and the lack of recognition. So there's a lack of recognition of the importance of science and the impact of science. But there's also, it seems to me, a huge lack of recognition for the importance of people who teach science. And that's an issue I think I'm sure all of you know, and I'm sure all of you have had experiences where you've been frustrated because not only have you perhaps not had the recognition of your efforts as best as should be done, but you also may have been frustrated by people who were forced to teach physics or who were found themselves in a circumstance where they were teaching physics who didn't have the right background, who didn't have the right knowledge, who didn't have any passion or any understanding or any ability to communicate that subject matter, not because they were bad people or anything like that, but just because they didn't have the proper training. And that's a real issue, as you know, I'm sure, far better than we do. And if our society is really to progress, we're certainly going to need the leadership and the support of everybody such as yourself who's here, and I just wanted to thank you very much for all of your efforts, because they are legion, and they are, I'm sure, largely unappreciated. Thank you very much.